Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Israeli occupation authorities are facing more protests today in Gaza as at least two Palestinians were killed and three were injured in an Israeli air raid and at the Gaza border. Israel has pledged an even tougher response to Palestinians, sending flammable kites and balloons carrying firebombs across the border. Next, a secret letter was just revealed yesterday from former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak to then CIA Acting Director Gina Haspel, asking for support in a competitive election last May. He painted current Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad as a threat to U.S. interests. Najib has since been indicted on several corruption charges, including abuse of power. Then, a South Korean court today sentenced former President Park Geun-hye to an additional 8 years in prison for abusing state funds and violating election laws. Park is already serving 24 years in prison for a massive corruption scandal. And then, Kathy Craninger, President Trump's nominee to lead the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, went in front of the Senate Banking Committee yesterday, where she fully dodged many senators' questions. What we did find out is that she has almost no financial experience, having worked most of her career in the Department of Homeland Security. So why is she the nominee for the CFPB? And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Israel and Gaza. Israeli occupation authorities are facing more protests today in Gaza as at least two Palestinians were killed and three were injured in an Israeli air raid. And at the Gaza border, during protests, Israel has pledged an even tougher response to Palestinians, sending flammable kites and balloons carrying firebombs across the border. We're joined from San Francisco by Richard Becker. Richard is an anti-war organizer and author of the book Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. Richard, welcome back. It's been a long time.
Thanks very much, John.
Richard, you know, it's easy to say things are getting worse because they always seem to be getting worse, but I feel like there's an unusual kind of tension right now on the Gaza-Israel border. And certainly the Israelis have shown no compunction over killing people. Tell us what's happening over there and what your thoughts are on it.
Well, we can see just in the last couple hours that there's been a major escalation and that the Israelis are using both artillery and sniper fire and also airstrikes against Gaza. And, you know, we have to recall that Gaza is completely surrounded. It's completely fenced in. It has no air defenses. It has none of that kind of weaponry. And yet, at the same time, we have Avigdor Lieberman, who is the so-called defense minister of Israel, saying that Hamas is dragging Israel into a broader military operation, and he warns that it could be in excess in terms of its magnitude of what they called Operation Protective Edge in 2014, where more than 1,400 Palestinians were killed, thousands more wounded, and immense destruction done. So I think this is the world turned upside down kind of coverage that we get from the Israeli media and from the U.S. media in regard to what's going on there.
Yeah, I've been astonished, although maybe I shouldn't be, at the media narrative around these demonstrations in Palestine. I mean, first it was, oh, there were riots taking place along the border of Gaza, and Israel just has to defend their borders. But, you know, of course, they don't actually have borders. They don't have any declared borders. But they have to defend themselves against these Palestinian rioters. And now the narrative seems to have shifted to focus on these flaming kites that are being flown across the border. I mean, to me, that reminds me of, you know, children throwing rocks at tanks during the Intifada. I mean, the extreme disproportionate use of force. What do you think?
Well, definitely. And you have Jason Greenblatt, who is the U.S., you know, formerly Trump's bankruptcy lawyer, who's now in charge of Middle East affairs, along with Jared Kushner, blaming Hamas today, putting out tweets in Arabic saying it's their responsibility. It's Hamas has caused the water to be polluted. Hamas has caused all these problems. And so we have a situation where, you know, as I said, they're really fenced in. It's a big open air prison, as people have often called it. And are the people just supposed to die quietly? Is that what the expectation is? Well, apparently, yes, that's what the expectation is from the U.S. leaders and the Israeli leaders. And that any form of resistance against this overwhelming oppression and repression that comes from the Israeli state, funded, of course, the military by the United States to a very large degree. You know, that's treated as normal. That's the normal, and then any resistance to it that's the aggression. So it really is, you know, this kind of retaliation is what we hear coming from the media from the Israeli side. But retaliation, of course, always implies that it's an act of self-defense, when in reality, it's just the opposite.
I want to expound on a point you just made, Richard, and that is how U.S. officials, who ought to know better, frankly, are just parroting what we see on Twitter from the IDF, the Israel Defense Force. This is an IDF tweet. It says, IAF jets recently conducted a wide-scale attack against Hamas military targets throughout the Gaza Strip, following a severe shooting attack against IDF soldiers this afternoon. The IDF is currently conducting the attack in various locations. Now, that was breaking news as of 1:12 p.m. this afternoon. But that is essentially exactly what came out of the White House. It was essentially an IDF press release that came out of the White House.
Yeah, so they don't have to worry about, you know, like doing too much work. They can just reprint those press releases and send them out and, you know, maybe put a different title up at the top, or a different address at the top, or a different contact person at the top. But that's the way that it really does operate. And I think even more so now than in the past, the really identity of interest that the White House sees with this extreme right-wing government, and it's not just the White House, it's most of Congress too, an overwhelming majority of Congress, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, who go along with this, but who really just parrot what comes from the Israeli military and the Israeli prime minister. And of course, you know, yesterday they passed a law that said that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people without, again, and as Walter mentioned, without any borders being defined, that, you know, that the settlements could be expanded, that's the right, and that the right of self-determination is for the Jewish people in Israel, but uniquely to the Jewish people in Israel. This is what that wording says. In other words, that the Palestinians have no rights whatsoever. And that is endorsed by Washington as well.
And another provision of that law was that it's officially in the national interest to construct these illegal settlements in occupied Palestinian land. I mean, this is like a deliberate provocation, right?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, that was a compromise wording because there was wording before that said it was okay for communities to decide who could live in their community, meaning that
segregation would be formally legal.
The Zionists can exclude the Palestinians. But the way they rewrote it makes it even more extreme and says that Jewish settlements are of national value and that they should be encouraged and supported, meaning that and of course that's what's going on now. I mean, this is what happened yesterday was really just an officialization of what the reality has been of an apartheid state. But that means that the government will be funding those settlements and providing virtually nothing to the Palestinians who are still forced to live under occupation in 48 or in the West Bank or in Gaza.
Let's go back to what you were saying earlier about the possibility of another full-scale war breaking out. The violence has been very intense since the March 30th Land Day demonstration. That's when the Great March of Return, these series of Friday actions began. Israel, started it off by massacring huge numbers of people. In fact, many more people than were killed in the original massacre in the 1970s, for which Land Day is named after. I think now it's close to 140 people who have been killed, thousands and thousands and thousands of people injured horribly. But you raised the possibility of like a full-on military intervention in Gaza, perhaps. Tell us a little bit more about that, if you would.
Well, if we look at the past 10 years, the end of 2008 into early 2009, there was Operation Cast Lead. Then in 2012, there was another major military assault on Gaza. And then in 2014, yet another, the one that was the deadliest so far. And the Israeli military has pursued this extremely cynical and anti-human terminology of mowing the lawn, meaning that periodically they seek to diminish the already very limited military capacity, fighting capacity of the Palestinians in Gaza. And the struggle is heated up. I think we should really look at this, that while the U.S. leaders called the Palestinians who are demonstrating, and Avigdor Lieberman, the defense minister, did it again today, called them terrorists, these are extremely courageous people, desperate because of the situation that they're in, who are demonstrating in the face of snipers and airstrikes and tank fire, artillery fire, because their situation is so desperate, but their courage is very great. So the fact that they continue to resist is what the crime is in the eyes of Israel. And it could bring about another major military operation, which Lieberman yesterday threatened, an operation bigger than the 2014 operation.
Richard, I have to ask you, in the last minute and a half that we have, do you see any possibility at all for some kind of a negotiated settlement or a ceasefire or any positive movement at all?
Well, it's difficult to see it, to tell you the truth. I mean, I'm not glad to say that, because any relief for the Palestinians, given what they've been suffering, would be very, very important, very critical. The fact is, Hamas offered a 50-year truce, a hudna, not long ago, after the beginning of the March of Return, in exchange for an end to the blockade. The Israelis rejected it out of hand. They just said, no, we're not interested in that. What they're interested in is continuing a campaign to crush the Palestinians in the West Bank, in Gaza, and I think inside the 1948 borders, too. In parts of Israel now, in northern Galilee, the Palestinians are the majority. That's unacceptable to the Zionist leaders, who want a racist, exclusivist state. And that's why they passed the resolution yesterday.
Okay, we will leave it there. That was the voice of Richard Becker. He joined us from San Francisco. He's a prominent anti-war organizer and author of the book Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
A secret letter was just revealed yesterday from former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak to then-CIA Acting Director Gina Haspel, asking for support in a competitive election last May. He painted current Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad as a threat to U.S. interests. Razak has since been indicted on several corruption charges, including abuse of power. We're joined from Singapore by Niall Bowie. He's a writer and journalist with the Asia Times, covering Singapore and Malaysia. Niall, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Niall, this is a big deal. This is a head of state, or head of government at least, openly asking the CIA to help him win an election. What do you make of this?
So what this letter was, it was drafted from an intelligence department inside the prime minister's office. It was sent 5 days before the May 9th election. What it did, it requested for the U.S. political support in the event that the election result would be very narrow, too close to call, a hung parliament, or even a super slim victory, even winning by one seat. So this letter shows it didn't so much ask for direct American support in winning the election, but it did ask for recognition. And it shows how nervous the ruling government was at the time. It sensed that this would be a very close fight, and it was pulling out all the stops ahead of this election to sort of suppress the other side. They rolled out this campaigning rule whereby you couldn't portray the faces of some party leaders on the same billboard. So what happened is they actually cut out the face of Mahathir Mohamad, the former prime minister of the country who was running for the opposition. And he's the longest serving prime minister in the country. And that, so these sort of tactics in the end sort of helped undermine Najib. You know, you have the deference to long serving political leaders. And Mahathir was someone who had such a sort of a social capital in Malaysia and among Malaysian voters and people like that. So it's no surprise that the thing went the way it did.
Can you give us a little bit of the detail, Niall, about what exactly it was that Najib Razak was asking?
Sure. Okay, so what this letter had contained, again, it wasn't written by Najib himself. It was written by a department in his, or a research unit, an intelligence unit within his department. So what it alleged, what it said, was that Mahathir in the past had been anti-West. He had been anti-Semitic, autocratic, silenced dissent, and disregarded human rights. It basically cast him in the worst possible light. You know, Mahathir, in campaigning ahead of this election, he joined the opposition and, you know, he embraced the reform agenda. And this letter said he is not a reformer, and the opposition hopes to use his political capital, his prowess, to defeat Prime Minister Najib's party, the ruling party that had been undefeated for six decades. And indeed, that is what happened. So it went on to say that the opposition, now the ruling government, the manifesto that they had articulated regarding foreign policy, the letter predicted that it would undermine bilateral ties between the U.S. and Malaysia. China is an aspect of it, too, a little later on. I'll get into that. And basically, the letter cast doubt about the ability of the opposition to manage geostrategic threats around the world. And, you know, unsurprisingly, the letter sort of cast Najib's 9 years in power in the most positive light possible, calling his policies sound and progressive foreign policies. There is one paragraph here that I'd like to read word for word, because it really articulates a perspective and a view of the region, which I think is pretty accurate, actually, but it sort of sums up this whole message pretty nicely. So it says here, unlike Mahathir, Prime Minister Najib is known to be a strong U.S. ally and would continue to support U.S. presence in the region. Without Prime Minister Najib in charge of the country, the U.S. stands to lose a reliable partner in Southeast Asia, given that the Philippines has broken away from Washington, Singapore and Brunei being too small to make an impact, and Thailand as well as Indonesia too immersed in their own domestic political problems. Meanwhile, the Indochina countries, except for Vietnam, are too inclined towards China. So that really paints an interesting picture of this part of the world in Southeast Asia, a region that is very much between these two competing powers, the U.S. and China, both vying for strategic influence in the region. And, you know, we had, under the Obama administration, we had an attempt to engage this part of the world through the Asia pivot, through the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was the whole economic angle in which he tried to engage these countries, you know, through trade and investment and whatnot. China, on the other side, has the Belt and Road Initiative. It has institutions like the Asian Investment and Infrastructure Bank. It has a parallel architecture, a parallel globalization, if you will, that is pretty much the only game in town at the moment. With Donald Trump coming into power, there has been less emphasis and interest in this part of the world. And accordingly, many of these countries have, over the last year or two, very much sided with China. And it's interesting that Najib's department, his prime minister's office, takes this stand towards the U.S. because he very much was playing both sides. So he was in power for 9 years. And he had very much improved relations with the United States. Under his tenure, he would go golfing with Obama, and U.S. ties were quite healthy. When the One Malaysia Development Bank scandal, the scandal at the Sovereign Wealth Fund, when that scandal occurred in 2015, which implicated the prime minister and even members of his own family, that very much spoiled relations with the United States. And since that time, and a little bit before, from around 2014, ties with China were increased and investment increased. Malaysia became a top investment destination for Belt and Road projects. So it's just an interesting stance that was taken here in this letter, very much playing both sides and very much taking the U.S. line pretty much verbatim on a lot of these strategic positions. You know, the letter later goes on to talk about the South China Sea and the importance of freedom of navigation. It pretty much just uses the language that the State Department uses to describe strategic objectives in the region. And just interestingly enough, before all this went on in 2015, 2016, Malaysia was forging a defense relationship with China, buying submarines, clinching huge deals, and also having the biggest joint military drills among any Southeast Asian country with China. So there's certainly an interesting dynamic there. And I was just curious, John, because, you know, you had worked in the CIA, and I'm just curious, how do you think a letter like this would be received, you know, given the political circumstances.
Well, that's the question there. Given the political circumstances, if this had been 10 years ago or 15 years ago, my guess is that they would have referred this question, this letter, to the operational component. And, you know, they probably would have come up with some sort of a plan to help a U.S. ally. But in this day and age, in 2018, that's just not the way it's done anymore. The risk of blowback is so severe, especially in an important and developed country like Malaysia, that my guess is when they received this letter, they just decided to ignore it.
This is an extremely interesting story. We're talking with Niall Bowie. He is a writer and journalist with the Asia Times covering Singapore and Malaysia. I just want to return to this question of relations with China, because when the new prime minister, Mahathir Mohamad, was elected, he initiated a review, like a comprehensive review of Chinese investment in the country following or during the tenure of previous prime minister who we're talking about, Najib Razak, who wrote that letter to the CIA, or whose office wrote that letter to the CIA. But this new revelation, it kind of complicates that narrative, right? It's not so much just Najib Razak, who is an ally of China, and Mahathir Mohamad, who's investigating all of this investment and might lean more towards the United States.
Well, that's all the time we have. We were joined from Singapore by Niall Bowie. He's a writer and journalist with the Asia Times covering Singapore and Malaysia. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
A South Korean court today sentenced former President Park Geun-hye to an additional 8 years in prison for abusing state funds and violating election laws. Park is already serving 24 years in prison for a massive corruption scandal. We're joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. How are you, Simone?
Pretty good, thank you.
Simone, this seems like an incredibly long prison term. It's essentially a life sentence. Tell us about this case and about President Park and why she got now 32 years in prison.
The charge is that the latest one is abusing state funds and violating electoral laws. For that, she has been, as you mentioned, already sentenced for more than actually 24 years. And then the specific charge on this one is that, the court found proven her guilty, is that she received $2.3 million from the National Intelligence Service while she was obviously serving as a president, which is a really completely egregious violation of law. And also, the court also found that she violated the election laws. As a president, Koreans, they're supposed to be neutral. They cannot interfere with the local national elections. So the court found that she broke the election laws. So in total, looks like more than 30 years of a prison sentence. However, the rulings of appeals court will be decided on August 24th. So we will see what's going to happen then. I think before that, probably for your listeners, we may need a little background. The reason why the former president and the impeached president Park is obviously in prison is as a result of as you recall, the very continuous massive people's protests, what it called now is a candlelight revolution, which started from fall of 2016 and ended all the way to spring 2017, which resulted in the impeachment. And as a result, so she was impeached on December 2016 and was removed from the office and the Constitutional Court found that, the impeachment finally legal and March 2017, and she was arrested and she has been going through a trial. And so this is basically the summary, and probably can talk, obviously, we can talk more about the more, deep, important issues. It's not just the longer sentence of this former president, but there's all this very serious political economic structure that led to, you know, this violation of election laws and constitution, and basically it was the revitalization or revival of you know, the former dictatorial regime, authoritarian regime under her father, Park Chung-hee. So that is pretty much, you know, a little bit of a sum up of what's going on.
Walter, before we started this segment, you made an important point that I think our listeners would be interested in too, that in an oddball kind of way, former President Park may have done a great service to South Korea. What's that?
Oh, well, you know, I was saying that the unsung heroes of all of this really exciting progress being made towards peace in the Korean Peninsula, the Inter-Korean Summit, which was sort of the spark that allowed for U.S.-Korean rapprochement, that was really the candlelight revolution, because if Park Geun-hye was still the president, I can't imagine a scenario, and Simone, I'm curious about your thoughts on this, but I can't imagine a scenario where there's a right-wing nationalist government in South Korea and all of this progress towards peace is made. I mean, I think it's only because the people of South Korea rose up and led to the ouster of Park Geun-hye and subsequently the election of Moon Jae-in that any of this happened.
Yes, you are right indeed. And I would not, I mean, I've been very closely following the, of course, involved in the candlelight revolution. And obviously, honestly, I had no idea, you know, I'm talking about this today. It was dark. It was we would never imagine that, you know, Park Geun-hye would have been impeached. And what this shows is actually the Korea's, the potential of Korea's and the power of Korea's very sustained the history of a popular resistance and movement again and again. We always get surprised. And, you know, I'll give you a very short sort of summary. You know, 35 years of Japanese colonization, that during that period, Korea has launched, as you recall, one of the most strongest resistance against the colonization. And when the end of 1945, Korea was again very strongly, you know, the popular movement against the military interim government. 1960 student revolt that ended, that also contested the authoritarian regime. 1980, the Gwangju People's Movement, peace movement, that was brutally suppressed. In 1987, there was another massive pro-democracy movement, and to skip and few, and now we have obviously 2016-17, the candlelight revolution. So what I'm saying is that you are absolutely right. Today, I mean, who would imagine 2018, you know, we have Panmunjom Declaration, we have, you know, despite all the skepticism, we have a Singapore summit where the President of the United States met for the first time, you know, Chairman Kim, and we're not today. Literally, we're talking about President Moon Jae-in says that, you know, ending Korean War, it is not full peace treaty, it's at least some kind of political declaration among North and South Korea and the United States is a goal in September. We are talking about also the repatriation of, you know, American soldiers. I think it's going to happen. The first segment is going to happen in probably July 27th, in 11th, the first time in 11 years, and all kinds of inter-Korean engagement news. So you're absolutely right. You know, in a way, this was the, you know, the removal of Park Geun-hye. Impeachment was actually, it was a catalyst, but it was not because of that. My point is that there this is undercurrent. There's no matter what happened, you will see Koreans, you know, have a very strong tradition of a popular movement, which, you know, it's, you know, emerged again and again. So I think that this has been one of those historical moment.
We have about 3 minutes left. In our last bit here, I wanted to go back to another thing that you alluded to earlier, about the economic structure of South Korean society and what Park's corruption scandal exposed about that. You were referring to the chaebol, right? These big business elites that are highly politically influential.
Yeah, basically the Korean economy, which although it is, you know, one of those economic miracles in Northeast Asia, it was very chaebol. Korea is a very powerful, you know, monopolistic chaebol based economy. And on the Park Geun-hye's all corruption scale was basically she was, you know, under also in the currently new, you know, deregulated neoliberal economy. There's a lot of room for corruptions and etc. So that was, part that people tried to contest. And one more thing I want to mention also is that this is very, very important. The massive workers' strike before even the beginning of the Candlelight Revolution, which a lot of people don't remember, that was actually the most important to me, the beginning of the Candlelight Movement. And just recently, the leader of the Korean Confederation Trade Union, who had been in the prison for more than 2 years, he's just recently been released. And so what I'm trying to tell you is that, again, yes, Park Geun-hye's, the longer prison sentence shows that what is more than just about one political leader. It is about massive popular movement. It is about contesting the very unequal, the economic capitalist structure that is imposed by United States and so neocolonial and also structure. And finally, one more thing I want to mention is that we just found out that how the Candlelight Revolution could have almost been brutally suppressed by the Korean Defense Security Command. There was a scheme, they revealed there was a scheme for the almost like a military coup that would have completely suppressed those thousands of candlelight people who participated in the Candlelight Revolution. And so what we're trying to show is that, yes, Korea, we have made incredible progresses and when it comes to democratization and also the peace process, but this struggle is still a very difficult struggle, and we have to continue to stay vigil, and we really need international solidarity.
Just about 30 seconds left, and that national security establishment that would have been involved in the bloody suppression of the Candlelight Revolution, I mean, they're generally hostile to dialogue with the North, is that correct?
We're talking about the Defense Security Command, which was going to suppress the Candlelight, which was actually created during the Korean War. These are special services corps that has the counterintelligence, criminal investigation capability, and they were actually used in 1979, coup d'etat of Chun Doo-hwan, right? Chun Doo-hwan, who suppressed at the time, the New Democracy Movement. So these people would like to sustain the Cold War. They would like to be, this is the core of their, the anti-communist, anti-North Korean power structure. And thankfully, I think the current President Moon Jae-in, hopefully, with the great support from the people and also from National Assembly, we finally should destroy this very horrible, oppressive, and anti-democratic structure.
We're going to have to leave it there, Simone. We were joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Kathy Kreninger, President Trump's nominee to lead the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, went in front of the Senate Banking Committee yesterday, where she artfully, really inartfully, dodged many senators' questions that were put to her. What we did find out is that she has almost no financial experience, having worked most of her career in the Department of Homeland Security. So why is she the nominee for the CFPB? We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net, whose most recent piece is Fighting Fake Stories, The New Yorker, Israel, and Obama. Jim, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jim, we already know that Donald Trump doesn't like the CFPB. He's tried to kill it more than once. Why put somebody like Kathy Kreninger in charge when she really has no idea what she's doing?
To help kill it. This is classic. The way someone like Trump, certainly, who's part of a Republican program to kill policies like this and agencies like this, they put in charge of social agencies like this people who are in principle opposed to them and are going to do their best to hobble them. I mean, Mike Mulvaney, whom she would be replacing, has been horrible. He's actually dropped lawsuits against payday lenders that the CFPB was winning in order to protect the lenders. He went after an auto title company in Mississippi that had ripped people off for $1.5 million and decided to settle with them for $500,000, which meant he let them keep $1 million in profit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Kathy Kreninger, is someone who has no experience. And this, her experience is that her qualification is that she's part of that same ideology, that she thinks an organization like this is something that hobbles business and has to be taken out of the way of business. You know, she worked for the Peace Corps in Ukraine in 1997, and she said it made her understand how important, how horrible communism was and how wonderful free market was. How communism and central planning were horrible. Of course, 1997 and following in Ukraine were hardly the epitome of communism. It was really the market at its best and worst. Anyway, so that's her qualification, that she's part of that ideology of business must be left, including predatory businesses, like payday loans, must be left to do their work in the free market.
Yeah, it's like the Scott Pruitt model, right, where you appoint somebody to lead an agency whose personal beliefs and ideology and interests are like 100% in opposition to the very purpose of that agency existing in the first place. I mean, Scott Pruitt, I think that's why he did all this outrageous, you know, what a lot of people would say outrageous corrupt stuff, you know, with this lavish spending on luxury items and you know, things that you don't really need. It's because, like, well, like, he doesn't care about wasting the EPA's money. He doesn't want the EPA to have any money in the first place. And maybe it's the same logic at play here with this nominee, the new nominee to lead the CFPB.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. This is what capitalist governments do. And this is the problem. And even if you have good social agencies that are in the public interest, if you have parties that represent business interests and capitalist interests, they can put people in charge of those agencies that hobble them. They do it with they can do it with healthcare agencies. They can do it with an agency like this. What's also interesting is this whole process now of confirmation hearings, where it's de rigueur that you avoid answering any questions. You know, don't let yourself get pinned down to a position. And she had some responsibility as she was the liaison, I guess, between OMB and Homeland Security. So she had some responsibility maybe for developing policies or instituting policies about this family separation. And Warren tried to get her to answer questions about that, which she wouldn't. She certainly, as an OMB person, has responsibility for the Puerto Rico disaster, which is a horrible disaster that does not get enough coverage. You know, she had responsibility for that. But, you know, these confirmation hearings now, they're coached in how to answer questions without answering them.
Oh, yeah. And she took it on the chin yesterday from some Democrats. I'm looking at a piece that was in The Washington Post saying that Senator Brian Schatz, a Democrat of Hawaii, said, quote, "I'm trying to get an answer from you and I just can't. And it's maddening." Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Massachusetts Democrat, repeatedly lashed out at Craninger for giving, quote, "lawyerly and limited answers. You're dodging me," Warren shouted. There's another quote here. She had another exchange with Warren, where Warren questioned Craninger's proposal to cut the CFPB budget by 23%, $147 million cut. And Warren asked her, with a cut that huge, are you going to fire civil servants? And her first answer was, that's not my budget, that's the president's, although I support it. And Warren asked her again, in order to achieve the 23% cut you have proposed, will you fire civil servants? And she said, certainly, I did support the development of that budget. So Warren asked her a third time, can you just give me a yes or no? Will you fire civil servants? And Craninger said, quote, there are laws in place that protect civil servants. So we still don't know if she's going to fire civil servants.
Well, we know that she, in fact, we know, I'm going to guess.
We do know.
I say that I know that she will, if she can.
If she can.
If she's allowed to by law. And that's why it's good to have laws that protect civil servants. But this is a classic case. They are very carefully coached from this level up to the Supreme Court level.
Yes.
To appear before a Senate committee and not answer the questions, not get yourself in trouble. And I don't think we're ever going to get beyond that. And it would be the same thing, I think, probably, if a Democratic nominee were appearing for Republicans who were grilling him. So I don't know. This is a problem that we have in the way this process runs now. And she's been well coached in this. And they don't really care. They know they have the votes.
And that's the bottom line. And even Democrats have acknowledged that the Republicans have the votes. Whether the Democrats like it or not, she's going to get this job.
And the longer it takes to put in place a permanent head of this agency, the longer that person is going to be in power in their head, because it's a 5-year term. So they're just extending that longer into the next presidency. And so the Democrats are trapped in that. They have to, you know, get someone in as quickly as possible. And they're not going to stop it. So, you know, this is they have to just they can just drag out and essentially filibuster the hearing until the vote comes.
The joke of a confirmation process, and John's right. I mean, this is not just this new CFPB nominee. This is how all confirmation processes go. I mean, it kind of makes a mockery of the idea that this is some sort of like democratic system, because one would assume in a democratic system there would be a public airing of the views of some of the most important political leaders in the country, like the people who are going to be leading these bureaus or the people who are going to be sitting on the Supreme Court. But you just get this. This circus where they, you know, come up with all sorts of creative ways to say nothing, and then people are just kept in the dark about those who are making decisions that affect their daily lives in very important and profound ways.
Well, I actually have a little bit different take on that. I tend to think this is, you know, and we see now it's really and it becomes a kind of pro forma thing, and it is a kind of a joke, especially at this level. But, you know, this is part of the process of the Constitution, the American constitutional system, which gives all these different ways. You got an approval of this and approval of that. Look, if you had a real political situation in the country, you'd have shadow cabinets. You'd have opposition parties, which would have a shadow cabinet, and you'd have someone who you knew was going to be the Secretary of the Treasury or the Secretary of, you know, and you'd see, and you'd get their positions beforehand and you'd vote for them. And when you vote for a party and a party wins the election, they shouldn't have to go. They really shouldn't have to go and have all their nominees, you know, vetted again by the Senate. You know, this is part of the American constitutional process, which puts in place checks, which are really checks on democratic will. And you got to think about it in that way, in another way, that, you know, it's a way of preventing change from happening. That, you know, we tend to like it when it works in our favor, not to like it when it works, but really the whole system is set up to have different stages at which essentially elite interests, the Senate, can stop something from happening which maybe the people voted for. So this is a tricky little situation. So it's part of the whole game that we have to play in the American constitutional system.
Yeah, you know, that's actually a really interesting point. I see what you mean. I definitely see the logic in that. And, you know, it's important for people to remember that the Senate, up until I think 1920, was not elected. I mean, the reason why all of these important sort of like vetting processes, you know, a lot of the checks and balances are with the Senate and not the House is because the Senate was, you know, the House of Lords.
Exactly. And and if people are arguing for that again, you know, the Senate shouldn't even be there. I mean, so this is all, you've got to realize the level at which the American constitutional system is profoundly counter-democratic, if not anti-democratic. And it's trying to prevent, deliberately designed to prevent radical changes coming up from democratic movements. So, you know, but this is the game we're stuck with because of that system, and everybody plays it their own way. But what you're seeing in it is that everybody's learned to play it. They've learned to play. If we have the votes in the House or in the Congress or in the Senate, we just filibuster the hearing.
Yeah, it's true. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Jim. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net, and his most recent piece is called Fighting Fake Stories, The New Yorker, Israel, and Obama. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a quick break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarik, filling in for Brian Becker.
It's Friday, so we will look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And we're joined in studio by Loud and Clear producer Nicole Russell. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Let's start with a headline which is neither worst nor misleading, but it's absolutely delightful. Headline of the week. People are donating money to Kylie Jenner to help her become the world's youngest female billionaire.
This is the most important cause I can even think about. I am so glad we're doing this.
Yeah, this is about a GoFundMe campaign. And let me just read the description, which is delightful as well. This is heartbreaking. I don't want to live in a world where Kylie Jenner doesn't have $1 billion. We must raise $100 million to help her get to $1 billion. Please spread the word. This is extremely important. Now, for the record, although Business Insider, from which this story comes, did not point this out, it is totally evident to me that this is a spoof campaign. Although it's real, it's a real GoFundMe campaign, but it's a total spoof, or actually, I'd call it a scam. because there's no indication that the person raising this money has any intention of giving this money to Kylie Jenner whatsoever. So it's a scam. But anyway, it's funny. And he or she has actually raised $2,271 as of a few minutes ago. So they're a little bit short of the $100 million needed to get Kylie Jenner up to $1 billion.
Well, I'm really hoping that after hearing about this, all of our listeners are going to go help poor Miss Kylie Jenner get to where she needs to be.
And Steve, Forbes magazine called her perhaps the next youngest ever self-made billionaire. Self-made. I don't know about that.
Not if you're getting money on the internet.
Or born into a super elite family.
Oh, sure.
The reason I love this story isn't so much the GoFundMe campaign. It's the actual story which accompanies it, which talks about Kylie Jenner, who's a member of the Kardashian family. And she's the sole owner, founder and sole owner of Kylie Cosmetics, which makes basically lipstick and some other things. But here's the... Here's how they describe her business. It's classic capitalism, classic American capitalism. The business is almost totally outsourced. Jenner does not directly make her products, nor does she sell them. Nor does she have to worry about the business's finances or day-to-day management, which is what her mother does that for in return for a 10% cut. So basically, as far as I can tell, Kylie Jenner sits around and thinks up clever names for lipsticks. And for that, and other people do all the work, including making the products and selling them and so on and so forth.
Including
and
her momager.
She's worth $900 billion. Or worth in quotes. Let me put quotes around that word, worth, please.
Nicole, that was mom and manager that you were saying, right? Just to clarify for her listeners.
Momager, Kris Jenner. Oh, man. Steve, this is so important, and I really appreciate you bringing this up today. This is really something. I mean, you know, you could raise money for anything. You could raise money for kids who have cancer. You could raise money for cats who need homes, very close to my heart. You could raise money to get immigrant families brought back together. But, you know, I think getting Kylie Jenner to the $1 billion mark is where we should really concentrate.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, sticking with capitalism and its absurdities, here's a wonderful headline from the LA Times, and this is actually what my favorite part about this. This is from a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter who has a regular column in the LA Times, and the headline in his column reads, "Employers will do almost anything to find workers to fill jobs, except pay them more."
Oh, my gosh.
And he really summarizes capitalism so well. This is, I think, the first paragraph of his article. "Of all the addictions that undermine stability in communities and society at large, truly one of the worst and most persistent is the addiction of corporate managements to pleasing their shareholders. Billions of dollars are funneled to owners of capital in the form of dividends and stock buybacks, while laborers go begging for even the measliest wage increases." This is, again, the LA Times. Kind of shocking to read something like this, not in the Liberation News, but in the LA Times. It's wonderful.
You know, you would think that you would want your laborers and the people working in your company to be, you know, at least well-fed and healthy, but I guess that's not actually the case based on this.
You know, it's really funny. A couple of the things you mentioned that corporations do with their money instead of paying workers more, I think it's worth talking about that because it really is funny. So, okay, you mentioned stock buyback. So that's kind of a technical financial term. But what that means is that a company buys its own stock. It has a ton of money left over at the end of the quarter. And it says, we wish that there was more demand for our stock. And so the company creates more demand for its stock by buying its own stock.
This is, of course, instead of, as noted, paying workers more, giving workers a bonus, increasing, you know, wages for people they're starting to hire. It's investing, or not even investing, just pay. It's paying themselves because also the higher up and like the board, their salaries go up because the stock has gone up.
And they're compensated in stock most of the time.
Exactly. It's absolutely nonsense.
Well, what do you say? Let's turn to Russia and today's story in the news, which really is blowing my mind because the establishment is absolutely losing their minds about Michael McFaul, who there's a proposal that, Bill Browder and Michael McFaul and some others would be questioned. But here's the headlines. Here's two different headlines, one from Business Insider. "Senate votes unanimously against turning U.S. officials over to Russia." And the headline from my local paper, the San Jose Mercury News, "Former diplomat offered as barter." Now, What's wrong with these headlines is they're complete nonsense. No one, and the articles actually talk about, you know, turning him over to Russia. That's not what the proposal was. If you go back and look at Putin's what Putin had to say in the press conference, the proposal is that McFaul and Browder would be questioned in the United States by U.S. officials with Russians present. There's no hint that anyone was proposing turning U.S. officials over to Russia.
Also, Steve, in exchange for being able to interview the 12 Russians who the entire news media was obsessed with just last week, and the fact that, you know, we would never be able to interview these people, which means we would never actually hear any of the evidence that's out there that the prosecutor has, if they have it, maybe they don't. So it's not like it's just a one-way thing. This is not just Trump just like giving people to Russia. It's not even that, right? Browder equated this to a death sentence, by the way, which I also found amusing.
I mean, what they're objecting to is classic American exceptionalism. Our indictment of the 12 Russians is completely legal and honorable and justified, and Russia's interest in the possible law-breaking of Michael McFaul and Bill Browder is totally unjustified and is just propaganda and so on and so forth. I mean, it's just classic American exceptionalism. We never do anything wrong. Nobody else ever does anything right, especially Russia. So it's pretty disgusting. But
oh my gosh.
Let's go to a completely different area, which is Syria. And this headline really annoyed me, and it's from the New York Times. And there was a strike in part of Syria, a town called Al-Susa, last week. And according to the BBC and Newsweek, which were the only English language media outlets to report this story, there were actually 54 people killed, including 28 civilians, by American or quote-unquote coalition partners in Syria. But here's how the New York Times ran the headline. U.S.-led coalition or partners may have hit Syrian area. They hit an area. They didn't kill any people, mind you. They just, you know, dropped bombs in the middle of the desert, according to this headline. And if you read the article in the New York Times, they just talk about dozens of quote-unquote people being killed. They don't, you know, categorize them as 28 civilians being killed. And I've checked, this story ran, I think it was on Monday, and I've been checking back every day since then. There hasn't been a word about this. So this is a story which the U.S. bombing killed 28 civilians in Syria. There hasn't been a single follow-up in the New York Times to clarify that. There's been nothing in the Washington Post or CNN. And this is just a classic example of what I call fake news by omission. That is, they mislead Americans or their readers by not reporting a story. And what makes this story so interesting and so significant is that the source of this story is the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is this one-man band in England, which we often criticize. But be that as it may, they are the go-to source for all stories from Syria. So if the Syrian government had killed 28 people, you can bet that'd be huge news and covered in all the press. But because the U.S. killed 28 civilians in Syria, according to the same source, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, the coverage has been essentially zero in the Western media. And it's just really disgusting.
That is absolutely disgusting. But Steve, I think we're out of time.
We are. We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. We were joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Pat. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And we were joined here in the studio by Loud and Clear producer Nicole Russell. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Oh,
love hounds.